am absolutely convinced in my time as Home Secretary that no action was taken by MI5 without authorisation.
Surveillance is a hugely intensive thing to do. It's great on the television, you just sort of walk down the other side of the street, don't you, and nobody ever spots you. It doesn't work like that.
Our understanding of Britain's security services is coloured by myth and make-believe, but this series is about the real spooks.
British intelligence agencies do not engage in assassination. They do not engage in rendition. They do not engage in coercive interrogation. That's not the kind of nation we want to be seen as.
In these programmes, I'll be investigating what Britain's security services really do and what they don't do, how they've adapted to the challenge of modern terrorism since 9/11, the controversies, the mistakes and the lessons learnt. And I'll be talking to some of those at the very heart of Britain's security establishment, including former members of MI5, senior police officers and a secret agent.
The collection of intelligence is at the heart of the security services' work. By gathering secret intelligence, we seek to obtain detailed knowledge of target organisations, their key personalities, infrastructure, intentions, plans and capabilities. MI5 website.
Working in the shadows, trying to discern things that others want to keep secret, will necessarily involve MI5 and the security services going beyond the boundaries of what's normally considered acceptable behaviour. But how far should they go? Sir David Omond became Britain's Security and Intelligence Coordinator shortly after the 9/11 attacks.
Secret intelligence is information other people don't want you to have. By definition, therefore, to get it, you're going to have to break some of the rules which, in an ordinary family circumstance, you would hope would apply. It's the equivalent to opening other people's letters or listening at keyholes or subverting people from their duty. There's a paradox here. If for reasons of morality, you conclude that there's no room for that kind of activity in a modern world, you won't get the preemptive intelligence and public security will suffer.
So MI5 is licensed to do things that others can't do. And a key part of their work is running agents.
What is an agent? An agent, or covert human intelligence source, is any human source able to provide secret reporting on a target of investigation. Agents are not members of the service. We call our staff officers, not agents. MI5 website.
Agents, run by both MI5 and the police, are crucial in penetrating terrorist organisations. Peter Clark is the head of the Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Command and National Coordinator of Terrorist Investigations.
Human sources obviously are vitally important. There are a number of sources of intelligence, but very often the best intelligence is that which someone with first-hand knowledge can give us. And so obviously we need to develop as many as we can.
But recruiting agents and protecting them isn't easy. Stella Rimington was MI5's Director General in the mid-1990s.
Well, if the human asset is in the right place and can stay in that place, they can bring you an ongoing stream of information about what's actually going on in real time. But because they are potentially the best source, they're also the most difficult source to find and to keep in place. And then, of course, once you use their information, then again there is a risk that you might endanger them. So they are very, very difficult both to acquire and to keep in place.
To get an understanding of what working as an agent for MI5 is really like, I was taken by my contact in government on a highly unusual journey. We met at midday underneath the clock of a busy mainline railway station. I was unaware, but a counter-surveillance team had already made sure I wasn't being followed. Once the all-clear was given, I was taken to a vehicle with blacked-out windows. I couldn't see out and had no idea where I was going. My final destination was a safe house. Inside, a man who has to follow the same security procedures every time he meets his handler. The reason? He's a young Muslim working as an agent for MI5. We've disguised his voice and used an actor to protect his identity. I was not told exactly where he operates or how the information he's provided has been used, but it was made clear to me that this man's life could be in danger.
I never thought of something like spying on something, because that's generally not allowed in Islam anyway. That's
generally not allowed in Islam anyway. But it was more about, if there's anything I can do to prevent the evil. I'm not going to go and spy on Muhammad buying halal sausages in the local store, because that's not what I do. I would never do that. But if I know there is a bunch or a group of Muslims who intends to do something and I hear about that or find out about that in whatever way, then, yeah, I was more than willing to see them again and talk about that. And if they asked me to query more about these individuals, then I felt that's okay, because these lads are not just the normal Muhammad or Abdullah praying in the mosque. They could be a potential hazard to me or potential, you know, I've got me and my family. I don't want anyone to blow up a bomb next to me or blow my family up.
How often do you meet?
If I've got things to tell them,
or if I've seen things, or if I've heard things, I like to meet them. But we don't meet daily. In a month, maybe a few, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times at the max. I mean, I can always contact them 24 hours anyway, even if it is 2 o'clock in the morning and they're asleep. They're going to answer my phone call. So yeah, if I really need to, I can do that, and I feel happy about that as well. But if there's an urgent need to get hold of them, you should be able to, and that goes 24 hours, even on Christmas Day.
It's a long process meeting your handler, I guess. It's not a quick, easy thing.
Yeah, it's a process, but it's a process you need to go through. Probably the same way you did today.
Can't be something you ever expected to do, though.
Not really. I'd never thought of that. I mean, I don't see myself as a spy in that sense anyway, because I'm just fulfilling my duty and my right as a Muslim citizen, you know, keeping my eyes out. But yeah, I never thought I would have personal contact with MI5.
It's not like the TV. It's not like the movies.
You don't think the people you meet from MI5 are like the people on the TV series? Are they a bit different?
Some of them look a bit dodgy. Some of them are ugly, some of them are nicer. You know, that's how it goes, you know? Men and women, big and fat, you know? Thin, chubby.
During the Cold War, the mission of MI6, the overseas spy agency, was to fight the intelligence war abroad. MI5's mission was to find Soviet spies working here in Britain and prevent subversion. But the end of the Cold War led to an identity crisis. What was it for? Stella Rimmington, MI5's former Director General.
There were many people going around saying we don't need those sort of services anymore because they're all to do with the Cold War. Whereas, of course, we knew that we were needed even more because we could see not only domestic terrorism coming out of Northern Ireland, but international terrorism was on the rise.
How did the kind of Islamist international terrorism issue move up the agenda while you were there?
Well, first it was pretty dispersed in a sense. We didn't have any clear sense, as far as I recall in those days, that we were working against one thing. Nobody had heard of Al-Qaeda in those days. The name hadn't crossed anybody's radar.
Did that change over time at all?
Not really. By the time I left, which was in the middle of 1996, we still hadn't heard of Al-Qaeda. The name Osama bin Laden had just about crossed the radar, and it was realised that there was this person who seemed to be responsible for some sort of funding.
Bin Laden's name crossed everyone's radar in 2001.
You'll recall that a few moments ago, I informed you that news had come through to say that 2 hijacked planes had crashed into the towers of the World Trade Center in New York.
Mass terrorism is the new evil in our world today. And we, the democracies of this world, are going to have to come together to fight it together and eradicate this evil completely from our world.
As eyes focused across the Atlantic, those at the heart of government worried Britain would be next. David Blunkett was Home Secretary.
I think there was a genuine belief that there would be a double hit. I think we were all very surprised as the weeks went by that Al-Qaeda hadn't planned that double hit on London as well as on New York and Washington. And therefore, in the very first few days, we were planning and preparing in case the security and intelligence wasn't able to pick up the signals and weren't able to actually prevent it.
Only one plane was allowed to fly from Britain to the US in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. On board were Britain's spy chiefs, including Eliza Manningham Buller, then number 2 at MI5 and soon to become the Director General. they dined with a handful of American counterparts at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. The atmosphere back home was frenetic. Manning and Buller later recalled that it felt like trench warfare. The danger was seeing enemies everywhere. Shami Chakrabarty was a Home Office lawyer working on counter-terrorism, who became head of the civil rights group Liberty the day before the attacks.
There was definitely a political knee-jerk after 9/11. Now, what is always difficult to judge is to what extent those not in government, those behind the ring of secrecy, were dragged along with the knee-jerk or were somehow pushing for it.
Shoes. Would you like to take off shoes, please? Shoes off, please.
Yes. 9/11 gave MI5 a new purpose, but it also posed new challenges. During the Cold War, intelligence almost always remained secret. But the threat of terrorism meant a single piece of intelligence could very quickly affect people's lives. How much should they be told? The problem soon became real for Britain's security chiefs.
Is any laptop here, sir? Any laptop here?
Back in February 2003, more than 400 troops, 1,000 police and armoured personnel carriers came here to Heathrow because of a crucial piece of intelligence of a threat to shoot down an airliner.
There has been intelligence, which I can't go into for operational reasons, which has meant that we have to take steps which have involved the reassurance of having the army and the police working together. The army will be working under the operational control of the Metropolitan Police, and there is a need for that.
It was a drastic measure, but in Whitehall they felt they had little choice. Sir David Owen chaired the meeting of the Cabinet's Crisis Committee, COBRA.
All the options were looked at. The first question, of course, was back to the intelligence agencies. Can you provide any more detail? Because it looked, on the face of it, as if the threat was very imminent. The answer to that was, in the nature of this information, no. This is all you're going to get. Can you afford to ignore it? Well, hundreds of lives could be at stake, so the answer there is no, you can't afford to ignore it. Could you simply warn some of the airlines most at risk? Well, you might as well shut down the airport. Should you shut down the airport? Well, then you're doing the terrorists' work for them, and you're disrupting one of our key lifelines. So gradually you work through, and we did, work through the options.
The first Ian Hutchison, head of security at Heathrow, knew about it was when he received a phone call.
I heard about it 9 o'clock the night before to say that there was intelligence of an increased threat to Heathrow and that the military would be deployed.
How did you feel about it, though, to see the military come into Heathrow?
It was a bit difficult, not knowing exactly what the threat was as to why they were there, but if people have decided that was the best way to mitigate the risk, then we clearly supported it and provided facilities for them to actually deploy as required.
The unprecedented sight of armoured vehicles at Heathrow worried people at home and in Whitehall, not least the Home Secretary, David Blunkett.
It was in the afternoon when my special advisers and some of my civil servants came in to say, look, the television pictures are pretty frightening and they worry people. Now, they weren't armoured tanks. Services were very keen to point out to me they were armoured carriers, but for the public, it looked frightening. I therefore rang and said, could we take another look at this? You're in operational charge. I'm not. That's constitutionally correct. But please have a mind to the impact on people's confidence and their own resilience, and they did.
Tonight at Heathrow, the authorities are not saying there was a plot to shoot down a plane, but they are taking the most widespread precautions for nearly 10 years.
The armoured vehicles had gone, but the pictures were all over the papers the next day, along with the suggestion it was all spin, part of the build-up to the war in Iraq that was just weeks away. The dilemma was how much to tell the public about threats at a time when scepticism about intelligence and government actions based on intelligence was increasing. Sir David Owen, Security and Intelligence Coordinator.
It was a hard lesson. I think we had, and I certainly had, underestimated the corrosive effect of the doubts over Iraq and the lack of trust in anything emanating from government.
There's no doubt at all that there is a degree of mistrust in the concept of intelligence for a number of reasons, but it has given us real difficulties.
Police counter-terrorism coordinator Peter Clark.
The allegation that was made then was that, oh, this was being done for political purposes, to help justify British foreign policy or something like that. Now, this is complete nonsense. You know, we, as in the police service, we respond to intelligence, and we do everything simply with the purpose of trying to preserve public safety. And I find it very... it is annoying when that sort of allegation is made. It's easily made and difficult to refute.
The security services never established whether the attack on Heathrow was really close. The trail went cold. Every crisis since 9/11 led to a rethink in government. A few months after the Heathrow crisis of February 2003, a new body came into being to try to cope with the waves of threat information. Called the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre, or JTAC, it's situated behind me at MI5's headquarters. Representatives not just from every intelligence agency, but from almost every government department sit there and sift through almost 1,000 pieces of intelligence every week.
Very often, of course, these intelligence tip-offs can't all be taken seriously, and the judgment about which ones to act on and which ones to leave is a very delicate one. So you really want the assurance that nobody is sitting on information which bears on that decision. So bringing everyone together, I think, was very important.
Sir David Omond. JTAC was formed to get all the relevant government departments to work with each other. One of the most important relationships for MI5 is with the police. MI5 can gather intelligence, but it's only the police who can actually arrest and charge. It's a relationship which has not always been easy. Stella Rimmington remembers the Cold War days when she joined MI5.
We tended, when we were doing espionage investigations, sometimes not to inform the police about them until the very end, when it was necessary to go out and arrest somebody. And not surprisingly, some police officers felt that we were not taking them adequately into our confidence. That relationship with the police obviously developed and got closer as we worked more and more against terrorism. But still, I suppose by the early 90s, I wouldn't describe it as universally close. And the time when we took over prime responsibility for intelligence work against the IRA in Great Britain was a time when relationships with the police were not good. Some of them, I think, felt that we were taking away their bread and butter work.
On occasions, I've described the old model as being where the police sometimes fed off the crumbs falling off the end of the intelligence table. That's what's changed. We're right at the table now from a very early stage, and my job as National Coordinator of Terrorist Investigations is to act as the bridge between the worlds of intelligence and the world of law enforcement. And over the years, that really has developed, and in the time I've been engaged in this type of work, I've been pushing all the time to make sure that flow of intelligence and evidence is a two-way process.
Peter Clark of Scotland Yard. The relationship is close now, but in the period after 9/11, there could still be tensions. Mike Todd took over as Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police in 2002.
When I first arrived, I can remember one example where the head of special branch came up to me and said, oh, by the way, your security service wants us to run this operation. And I said, well, hang on a minute, that's interesting terminology. What do you mean they want us to run this operation? And, you know, we should be making those decisions. And it was just an interesting moment because they weren't considering at that stage the community impact of running an operation with actually a low chance of success.
Understanding communities did not always come easily to MI5 after 9/11. Were they and the police also missing some important changes within those communities? Chris Fox was president of the Association of Chief Police Officers at the time.
To some degree, we backed off, across the whole country, not just in London, we backed off making direct contact with the clerics and the imams in the mosques because we didn't want to be seen, if you like, to be intrusive and oppressive. And we missed what was a lot of information that was actually open source. Well, you didn't have to be, if you like, James Bond to find it because it would be on the mosque notice board.
In 2003, it still looked as if the threat was coming from abroad, but in 2004, it became clear it was closer to home.
Whatever going and pray in the mosque now? I don't. I always go and find an empty room and go and pray in there. Why? I don't want people to see me what? Praying. I don't want people to know what? I'm religious.
The words are hard to hear because they're conversations recorded using a microphone hidden in a conspirator's home. The voice is that of Jawad Akbar, one of a group of British men who'd come to the attention of the security services. They were planning something.
The decision has still not been made. I might be going in about a month and a two's times, yeah? Or I might be going in a year's time. Whichever the two, I don't want no one to know I'm religious. Do you understand? Whatever they're going to make me do is going to be someone who's going to act like completely stupid. They're going to train me up and probably send me back here, act like completely stupid and do a big mission. Do you understand?
What became known as Operation Crevice quickly expanded into what at the time was the biggest ever joint operation by MI5 and the police, so large that other priority investigations had to be temporarily suspended. The men were buying fertiliser for a bomb and discussing what targets to hit. Only some of the recordings have been released, and because they're hard to hear, we've substituted the voices of actors using transcripts from the trial.
Imagine you've got a plane, yeah?
You buy tickets for 30 brothers in there, yeah? Massive brothers. Their only job is just to crash the plane. You're going to do it easily.
30 brothers? To find 30 brothers who are willing to commit suicide is a big thing.
Yeah, but maybe you got it. If you spoke to some serious brothers, to the right people, you'd probably get it, bro.
30 brothers who would be willing to give their life?
Yeah, you'd get it, bro. Whether they were from abroad or something, you'd get it. 30 brothers on a British Airways flight got up. 30 brothers on a plane. And what your job is, you don't have to fly into a building, just crash the flipping thing.
Operation Crevice was, I've been told by one intelligence officer, the moment when the lights went on and you could see the state of the kitchen. But had MI5 and others missed the emergence of the homegrown threat? Chris Fox was president of the Association of Chief Police Officers.
We knew there were people who were British-born, or at least very, you know, long-term British residents, who were living very productive lives and in quite middle-class, professional type of world. We knew they were people that were active. We rather expected that the actual operatives would come from somewhere else.
While some believe the intelligence agencies were looking in the wrong direction, Sir David Omond believes the process of radicalisation was only just beginning.
It took time for that phenomenon to occur. The radicalisation of young people, the drip, drip, drip of the video images and the internet images, and the activities of some of the radicals and extremists who were stirring up trouble. And it took time for that to have its effect.
Operation Crevice would later cause the biggest controversy for the post 9/11 MI5. But it's also an operation which gives us real insight into how MI5 goes about its work.
Directed surveillance operations involve the covert monitoring of targets' movements, conversations, and other activities. This work is carried out by highly skilled specialist surveillance officers who may work in vehicles, on foot, or from fixed observation posts. Our surveillance section often works in close cooperation with others. MI5 website.
The observation log started at 7 a.m. that morning at 56 Hencroft Street. At 7:02, the Vitara was parked on the driveway. At 11:56...
Transcripts from the Crevice trial reveal just how involved and laborious the process of what MI5 calls directed surveillance, following people around, can be. There were a total of 33,000 man-hours of surveillance.
At 1:15, Mahmoud was seen to leave the company of Khayyam at Herschel Street and ran back to the home address at 56 Hencroft Street. Khayyam went to the Universal Internet Cafe at Herschel Street. At 1:25, Mahmoud also went into the premises. At 1:46, both left the premises before going to the Chicago Chicken Burger premises on Park Street.
Surveillance is a hugely intensive thing to do. It's great on the television. You just sort of walk down the other side of the street, don't you, and nobody ever spots you. Or you follow them in a car, two cars behind, for 50 miles and nobody ever spots you. It doesn't work like that. It's a much more complicated thing to do because people are very alert. So you need quite a number of people to follow one. And those people need cars and you need organisation, they need communication. And if you're going to do it for 24 hours... we need a lot of people. That would be just one target. So it could suck up all your resources if you weren't careful. That is why you choose your priorities. And that is why I'm afraid we will always miss somebody.
Chris Fox. The investigation also involved other members of a branch of MI5. Their job was to install listening devices, bugs, covertly on people's property, in this case in the flat and cars of those being watched. This produced 3,000 hours of audio. The biggest dilemma for police and MI5 was working out when to stop gathering intelligence and when to close in. Peter Clark.
At that time, it was the largest surveillance operation that we had mounted in a counter-terrorist case, and it went on for many weeks. But it had to be done. It had to be of that scale because we had to be as sure as we could that the British public weren't going to be attacked by this group whilst we had them under surveillance. And remember that it was during the course of this operation that the Madrid attack was launched. So that was weighing heavily on our minds as we were looking at this group, and indeed as we actually heard them phrasing what had happened in Madrid.
It's 8:10. Rush hour in Madrid, a great city, heaves itself into life, but today with heavy heart. The station across the road from me looks as I suppose it looks every morning. You wouldn't know that a few hundred yards along the track is a broken-backed train.
The terrorists' car was bugged, which meant the surveillance officers could hear them listening to Radio 4 that day.
Hello, Frankie. How you doing? All right, mate, yeah. Yeah, mate, yeah, I'll come in with you. All right, bye.
If that was done by the brothers, that's what you call wicked planning, innit?
Only thing that makes me consider, yeah?
Yeah?
Is the way they said people in the train station, innit, were all over the place. They all went off one time.
Was it all one train? Are you sure? 100%? Was it not three different trains?
Planting the bugs to eavesdrop on conversations like the ones we've just heard dramatised involves a legalised form of breaking and entering. The power to enter someone's property without them knowing, install a listening device and then record their conversations is a key weapon in MI5's arsenal, a power abused by many security services in police states.
One of the recurring myths about the security service is that we bug and burgle as we please. This is not true. The service does use intrusive investigative methods, such as eavesdropping in a target's home or vehicle. However, our use of such methods is subject to a strict control and oversight regime. MI5 website.
Bugging and burgling, which Peter Wright first described it in that way in his book Spycatcher, is really what that means, is the planting of microphones in order to overhear conversations. And that's one of the sources of secret intelligence. But of course, that is done nowadays under warrants. So it's not a question of MI5 walking out in the street and deciding to bug and burgle people. A whole process goes in before that happens of making a case of why that is necessary and getting a warrant from a government minister to do it, etc.
Stella Rimmington. Every time MI5 wants to enter someone's property, they need to get a warrant. The Home Secretary is responsible for authorising, saying yes or no to each specific action, but not for deciding who to bug or follow or what operations to run. That power remains within MI5 in order to prevent it being used as a political tool. Sir David Omond.
The Home Secretary has to keep abreast of the work of the service and has to be prepared to go to Parliament to explain what is going on, knowing that the individual decisions are not political decisions. They are the decisions of the professionals in the service. In that way, I think the public can have great confidence that this highly effective intelligence apparatus and security apparatus is not being used for political purposes. There is no way that a minister, a Home Secretary or any other minister can direct the security service to work on this target or that target.
Home Secretaries have to sign off each and every warrant and renew them every 6 months when they automatically expire. Former Home Secretary David Blunkett saw a huge increase in warrants during his time.
The number of warrants having to be signed literally quadrupled, and when I left we were talking about around 2,500 a year. So it was a big job.
And would you really question the
person putting a warrant before you about whether it was justified? Did you ever turn any down?
Yes, I did turn warrants down. Obviously, under security regulations, I wouldn't be able to reveal any details, but I think it was my job to do so. And where there was real concern or further evidence, they came back to me and we had a sensible conversation.
And how much information would they give you about why they needed a warrant?
Oh, as much as you needed. They would have to spell out in detail why it was required, what the level of risk was, because otherwise you have what you might call creep or drift, where, understandably, in order to be able to link what was happening with organised crime to counter-terrorism, you strayed over the boundaries of what it was that you were approving.
What was the reaction from MI5 when you turned down a warrant?
Well, on one or two occasions, sort of gasp, and I said, well, there's no point in me being here if I don't actually analyse and make a judgement. We might as well just hand it over to you and you do what you want.
And it doesn't end with the Home Secretary. All the warrants are subject to random checks at a later date by commissioners. The commissioner who oversees the bugging side of MI5's work and checks whether the Home Secretary has been doing his or her job is Sir Paul Kennedy.
All I can tell you is that they do occasionally refuse them. And as it happens, I've seen one in the last few days which was refused. I do incidentally look at them when they've refused them because I think it helps me to understand their process of working. But I find that encouraging. I wouldn't like them to refuse them as a matter of course, but it's very encouraging to find that there is an odd one refused because it shows that an independent mind has been brought to bear on the subject.
What kind of reasons might a Home Secretary refuse a warrant for?
I will deliberately move away from any particular example, but the sort of thing which would impress me if I were in that position would be if it were an individual warrant in relation to a particular individual and possibly the need for it was no longer extant. Perhaps it had come into existence originally for good reason, but nothing had emerged in the last few weeks, possibly a few months, and it was no longer justifiable to keep it in place and was thought to be unduly intrusive.
But not everyone is sure that there's enough oversight in this process. Shami Chakrabarti from Liberty.
I am not confident that the mechanisms are as robust as they will need to be. To give you an example, my organisation accepts that you will need to tap suspects' telephones if you think that they are potentially engaged in terrorism. It's completely necessary and proportionate in a democracy to tap a terror suspect's telephone. And you may have to tap many telephones. But I do think it's wrong that these telephone intercepts are authorised by politicians in the first place and only vetted subsequently with hindsight by a commissioner.
Occasionally, attempts at surveillance come to public light. For instance, when a builder claimed MI5 had asked him to help bug the Pakistani High Commission in London whilst it was being renovated. As Home Secretary, was David Blunkett asked to sign a warrant?
I can't say anything about what we did in terms of the use of surveillance, and it would be quite wrong for me to do so. All I can say is that I was always absolutely scrupulous to make sure that what we expect for ourselves when we are outside this country we would respect in terms of how we treat other people.
And are you also confident that the security services would never do something without getting a warrant from you, without going through the proper channels of authorisation?
I am absolutely convinced in my time as Home Secretary that no action was taken by MI5 without authorisation.
David Blunkett did authorise the Crevice warrants, and in places like Crawley and Uxbridge in the spring of 2004, the net was closing in on the plotters. This reconstruction is taken from transcripts of surveillance used in court.
What I'm saying, right, what they're saying, the resources from this country, the electricity, the gas, going into the alarm engineers, stuff like this, yeah? That I'm saying is good. Get brothers in each and every field, from the gas, to the electric, to the water, to the alarm engineers, everything.
Bruv, just before we think, you don't think this place is bugged, do you?
Nah, I don't think it's bugged, bruv. At all. I don't even think the car's bugged. What I'm doing, yeah? If they knew about it, they wouldn't even wait a day, bro. They wouldn't wait one day to arrest me, yeah? Or any of us.
A few weeks later, the police moved in.
8 men are held after one of Britain's biggest anti-terror operations involving 700 officers. Police find half a ton of chemical fertiliser, a key ingredient for bombs in previous terror attacks.
Earlier this year, 5 of the 8 men arrested in Operation Crevice were jailed for life. The event marked a watershed for Britain's security forces. Peter Clark.
This was the first occasion on which we had seen clear intelligence of a significant group of young British men looking to construct bombs here and to detonate them here. And it was terribly important for us that in that case we were able to follow the leads to the point where when we made the arrests we could be sure that we had very, very strong evidence, because we had faced a lot of criticism for making arrests and then not perhaps following through to the point of charge and prosecution. And it was quite clear to me that if we were to make the arrests of, a large group of young British men and then not to be able to pursue it through the courts, my sense was that the criticism we would come under and the damage that could do to community confidence in our counter-terrorist efforts could possibly be such that it could inhibit our ability to mount similar operations in the future. So Crevice was hugely important in a number of ways, but in particular, that was the challenge we faced. Young British men intent on mass murder here, but we had to get the evidence before intervening.
But the story was not over. There was more that MI5 and the police would discover. Next week, we'll be looking at the controversy surrounding the London bombings of 7/7 and whether MI5 had sometimes stepped over the line.
If they knew about it, they wouldn't even wait a day, bro. They wouldn't wait one day to arrest me yet, or any of us.